This is March 25th, 2024, and at the suggestion of some Sangha members, I'll be sharing the events of the last 2 or 3 weeks regarding Gerardo Roshi. I'll just dive in. About 6 weeks ago, Gerardo called me to report quite a severe weight loss, and then a little later he wrote back and he said that tests had revealed that he had lymphoma. Turned out to be a very late diagnosis. I heard down there that he may have had it for many months without knowing it. And then from there, he had to wait and wait. It was quite baffling. We got all kinds of mixed reports from the physicians and nurses down there, from various Sangha members of Casa Zen, his Sangha. It was quite confusing, actually. It sounded so serious that I was just on the verge of booking a flight down there. And then came the report that a physician had seen him. This is all in Mexico, of course. A physician had seen him and said, yes, he's very frail, but he's not in critical condition. And so I postponed my trip. I really was aiming to be there as close as possible to his death, whether it was this year or 10 years from now. It's a great privilege, as I'm sure some of you know, a great privilege to be at someone's bedside as they're dying. There's a time once when I was in Rochester when a former Sangha member who was very active with the center many, many years ago, 50 years ago, I got word that he was near death at Strong Hospital, and his wife asked if I could go there, and I did. I went right over there, and he was indeed in critical condition, and I did what I heard was the thing to do, was chant the Prajnaparamita, sort of the fundamental sutra in Zen and perhaps in Buddhism generally. And I was chanting loudly in his ear, because that's often necessary for the dying person to hear. And I chanted and chanted and chanted. I was getting tired. And then his wife, who was standing at his side, said that he died. But she also said that he died with a smile. Now, whether I'm making too much of that, I don't know, but it still feels like a privilege to be with someone as they're dying. What event of one's life, my life, anyone's life, could be more important than that moment? I hadn't been able to be at Roshi Kaplow's side when he drew his last breath. I was in Germany giving sesshin, but I heard that it was very, very moving, that it was so gentle that the people there, this is in the back garden of the Zen Center at Arnold Park, the people who were there at his side said they couldn't even tell when he had drawn his last breath. That's how peaceful it was. Anyway, I knew that I knew that with Querétaro, I really could only go to Mexico once, and so I put off my trip until things turned even worse, and they did. On the morning of March 15th, during the morning Zoom sitting, I got word from his daughter that he had died just then with her brother, Gerardo's son, at his side. And then I just felt I had to get there right away, for no other reason, if for no other reason than to help out with all the arrangements, the funeral, and so forth. So I was able to get a flight that very day, the same day he died, and get down there. It was quite a shock. I just wasn't thinking it would be that fast, that sudden. And for the first time in decades, when I arrived in the Mexico City airport, it was not Gerardo who met me. Let me say a few things about Gerardo and his family. He and I go way back. We had some kind of karmic affinity, as we say in Buddhism. Not to mention just he himself having a strong karmic affinity. Long, long ago, his wife at the time, his wife had found her way to the Rochester Zen Center. This is the late 70s, I think. And she got involved with the Sesshin head monitor at the time. Just to make this brief, it seemed that basically, they had an affair, and the monitor stole Gerardo's wife away from him. That's maybe a little too simple, but yeah, basically. And I thought at the time, oh, how many lifetimes will it take for Gerardo? He was not a Sangha member then. How many lifetimes will it take her husband to get over that and find his way to the Dharma? Well, to my amazement, it was the opposite. He just plunged in. He's now out there divorced. He plunged into practice at the center with great devotion, great ardor. And became an important member of the Sangha down there, Casa Zen, and grew quite close to Roshi Kapil and to me. He spoke good English. That wasn't to be taken for granted down there. And over the years, this is now starting in the late 70s, over the years, he and I became quite close. There came a time in 1986 where I had decided I wanted to learn Spanish. I was already growing closer to the Sangha there. I had been making trips to Mexico City from the village where Roshi Kaplow and Polly and I were staying, working on his books. I would drive over the mountains and just conduct sittings there. As time went on, and I wanted to learn Spanish, Roshi Kaplow gave me strong endorsement to do that, no doubt thinking that, okay, I have some future helping out the Mexican Sangha. It was a 6 weeks intensive Spanish course in Cuernavaca. Now, Cuernavaca is about an hour south of Mexico City and very famous, I've learned, for its language schools, Spanish especially. And Gerardo and his family had a compound there, quite a sizable property of several buildings. They'd had it for a long time. I guess ever since his parents moved there, they moved to Mexico to flee McCarthyism, Gerardo said, in the United States. His mother was American, from Pennsylvania, and his father was from Spain. And here's something else Gerardo told me. His parents were friends with the family of David Brooks, the New York Times columnist. Gerardo said he remembered the Brooks family visiting them there in the family property. He remembered little Davy Brooks scampering around the property in his shorts. And over time, Tepoztlan, the village where Roshi Capo and I were and Polly were staying, it was just 20 minutes, 25 minutes from the Gali family property in Cuernavaca. And I know Gerardo's mother became quite fond of Roshi Caplo, and they would talk about yoga. They both did yoga. I heard from one of them that they used to have little headstand contests. Who could stay in headstand longer. I visited the compound there when Gerardo's mother was dying. And over the years, I got to know Gerardo's son and daughter. Remember Gerardo going out and pretty frequently taking his son Daniel out to the two of them to fly radio-controlled planes. And wouldn't you know, Daniel became an engineer, an aerospace engineer. He was hired right out of University of Michigan to work at Boeing, pretty high placed position in Boeing. And then before all these problems with Boeing aircraft began, he was hired, or maybe in the middle of those problems, he was hired a couple of years ago to work for Blue Origin. That's the Jeff Bezos company. And now Danielle told me last week that he's working on a lunar landing craft on the moon. All that you can trace back to those trips out to the field with his father flying planes. Cassandra, the daughter, became extremely successful in karate. She won tournaments all over the place. I think once she won the Mexican championship. Danielle lives in Seattle there, and Cassandra now lives in Cambodia. They both rushed to Mexico. As I said, Danielle was with his father as he died, and Cassandra was not too far behind. I used to, during those 6 weeks, I was taking Spanish. I would be, I'd had the house to myself because the house was not finished yet. And just remember, if you permit some reminiscing here, remember just doing homework, my Spanish language homework there alone in that house. Another of many reasons I felt grateful, still feel grateful to Gerardo. Speaking of gratitude, Gerardo and his wife at the time had insisted that the two children speak only English at home. They knew that they would easily enough pick up Spanish in school, but they wanted to give them a good grounding in English. And Danielle told me last week when I was there that, there were times when they resented having to speak only English at home. But he said he's very grateful now with the currency it gives him all over the world, speaking fluent. Fluent, bilingual. Gerardo always had a tendency to skirt the law. He knew how fond I was of mangoes and papaya and other Mexican fruits. So the papayas, this is may come as a surprise to some of you, the papayas, it's legal to bring papayas into the United States, unlike most fruits. But the mangoes, he would bring to me in sealed cans, like aluminum cans with labels of, you know, jalapeno peppers or cilantro or something. Now, tell me, how would, from whom or where would you find the means to have mangoes and other fruit sealed in cans to get across the border? I used to tease him about that, about his connections he must have had. But like so many things, he played his cards close to his chest. Getting information out of Gerardo was like pulling teeth. Skirting the law, he also he found a way to settle when he was. When he was stopped for a traffic violation by the Mexican police, the federales, he would find a way to settle it there. But not just by paying the police in cash, but he went further. He told me that he would sometimes have to haggle with them. They would say, "All right, we'll go on our way and this will be resolved if you can pay, I don't know, 200 pesos. And Gerardo would push back. You know, this is him in the car. Gerardo in the car and the cop right there, on the right, standing next to him. And he'd say, "Oh, come on, 200 pesos, 75 is the most." And then they would get into haggling. And there were other things that Gerardo found a way to get things done. There's a saying in Mexico, and here's the saying: in Mexico, there's always a way. I found the same myself. Once I was again with Roshi and Polly, and we were made one of our very infrequent trips into Mexico City. And some incredibly minor thing where that I did driving the car in front of, like, just the tires going 6 inches over some kind of a line in a big, huge intersection. And the police saw the New York license plates and came. You could just see the dollar signs in their eyes. They came over, and with that big, beautiful white grin, they said something about an infraction and so forth. And of course, their expectation, the police's expectation, is that we settle the matter there. Roshi was incensed. He just did not want to be part of this whole system of bribery that is just part of the endemic corruption in Mexico and so many other countries. And so he said, no, we're not going to do it. We're going to fight this. And finally, Polly and I persuaded him to let it go, save ourselves a lot of time. Same thing happened once when I was driving with my wife in Acapulco, where I did do a slightly more serious infraction. I made a U-turn, and they came down on me. And the cops said, "All right, you have a choice now. You can pay this ticket." He had written out the ticket. You pay this ticket. Take it on Monday to the municipal building, or we can just settle it now. What would you like to do? I said, "Oh, I'd like to settle it now." And so he said what the quote fine was. And I told him, honestly, I said, "I don't have that much. Let's say let's go back to 200 pesos." I said, "I only have 75. And he pushed back, and I actually opened my wallet and I said, "Look, this is all I have is 75. And well, he took it and off he went. Most of all, I'm forever grateful to Gerardo for years and years and years and years of him explaining things to me about Mexico and making me understand the marvelous, marvelous things about that country, about the people. He opened my heart. He really opened my heart to Mexico. When Roshi Kaplow asked me to go down there to help him work on his books, I had no interest. I'd never had any interest in going to Mexico. Zero. It's the last place I'd want to go. But duty called, and in no time, I just fell in love with the Mexicans. And to this day, I just have to go there. Just about every year, I have to go back and get my Mexico fix with these wonderful, wonderful people. The way that they're misportrayed is just a crime. There are no harder workers. There are no harder workers I can imagine in the world than the Mexicans. And one little final snippet of memory of Gerardo was when we were together in Sweden for the celebration of the Swedish Sangha's 30th anniversary. It was quite an event, a weekend event with all kinds of events. And it included, near the end of the weekend, it included music. There was a band, two or three or more of the band were Sangha members, and they were performing outdoors. It was nice weather, summer in Sweden. They're performing outdoors, and there were all of us, this big Swedish Sangha, and those of us who were guests there. And they were playing. It was a rousing, I think it was a jazz band. I don't know, but it was great. It's great music, but no one was dancing. Not that people were asked to. It's just that there were a lot of people there listening, until I noticed that this one guy, Gerardo, was quietly dancing on his own. Quietly, discreetly even, persistently, he just kept dancing, just little movements, feet, with a big smile on his face. And what was remarkable is that he just kept doing it alone, there in the middle of all of us. He just was having the time of his life dancing. And then it caught on. Then it became contagious. One, two, three of us joined him in just dancing individually. And before long, the whole crowd, it seemed, just about the whole crowd were dancing. It was really I've never seen anything like it. Well, just one person, it was enough for he himself to just do this on his own, but to keep doing it and doing it and doing it and just enjoying himself, and it just spread. Very, very, it says so much about Gelaro. All right, back to the funeral. When I got there, of course, the Sangha was grieving. Gerardo's body had been moved to a funeral home. I was invited to stay in his room. Casa Zen was the Zen center there, and that's where also where Gerardo lived alone. First we had my second day there, we had a memorial service. Now, to clarify, as I've always understood, the difference between a Buddhist memorial service and funeral service, you can have any number of memorial services. There's a whole formula in Japan of the memorial service each day for the first 7 days, and then each week, once a week for 7 weeks, and then on and on. They have a whole elaborate schedule. And you can have memorial services on the same day everywhere. Yeah, there was one in, I know, in Rochester. But so the first day we had the memorial service at Casa Zen itself. And then after some discussion, we decided to have the funeral service with the body on display in the casket at a funeral home. The reason was that just Casa Zen was just not large enough for the, I don't know, 50 or so people who we expected to come. Not all of them Sangha members, some of them people from work, Gerardo's employees. The next day, we had the funeral home for 24 hours. So the first day, first afternoon, there was the wake where the body was in display there, and people, anyone could come. We went over there. But the service itself, the funeral service, again, there's only one funeral service. It could be many memorial services, but the funeral service was the next day, a Sunday. We had no time for a rehearsal. It's always risky to do any kind of ceremony that involves more than a few people to do it without a rehearsal, but that's just what we had to accept. Just to give you a picture of things there, someone in the Sangha removed the, it's a Catholic funeral home, or I don't know if it's fair to say it's Catholic, but let's put it this way. At the end of our funeral service, someone there, the director of the funeral home, said it's the first Buddhist funeral service they had there in 15 years. So Mexico is a Catholic country. And we were able to remove the crucifix and instead place the Buddha figure with from the Zendo, the Casa Zen Zendo, there. And then before the ceremony proper started, before the funeral, I gave a talk. I've heard since then that my talk was about the only thing that really came through on Zoom, that it was otherwise a disaster, technological disaster. But these things are, it's always this, when there are people there, and there were all kinds of people who weren't in the Sangha, who came to pay their respects. It's always an opportunity to educate people. And that's what I tried to do. I said that a funeral service or a memorial service, either one, is based on the teaching of rebirth. Believe it or not, there is rebirth. And what I said, for those of you who didn't hear, was that we can see anything, reality, the whole matter of reality, from two sides. Many of you have heard this. From one side, like it's like two sides of a coin. From one side, we could call that the side of the essential, the unconditioned, the absolute. There is no here or there, now and then, before and after. From that side, where could Gerardo have gone? He's here. From the other side of the coin, the side of the relative side, the side of change, of karma, he has entered this intermediate stage between death and rebirth, what the Tibetans call the bardo. And that's really what a funeral service is for, primarily, is to help the deceased through this intermediate stage, so that he or she is most likely to have a favorable rebirth. The idea is that after we have died and lost our whole coping defense structure of the body mind, we enter this realm of vulnerability, where we come into confrontation with our karma, all of our conditioning, images, thoughts, memories, fears, joys. And in that very kind of defenseless, vulnerable state, the deceased can be helped through this memorial service. The service begins with chanting, the usual chanting. The Prajnaparamita, the Kanongyo, the Shosaimyo, the Daishin. These are all really directed to the deceased. Yes, the understanding in Buddhism is that especially the first 3 days after death, there is some kind of hearing. And don't ask me what that means, but there is some kind of hearing that is still happening. One, according to some sources, hearing is the last sense to go after death. And that by chanting these classic chants, such as the Prajnaparamita, we are reminding the deceased of the truth, the nature of reality. And you could say the most important part of it all is, near that, the beginning of the Prajnaparamita, form is only emptiness, emptiness only form. And that's the key to moving through the bardo, through this intermediate realm, without too much distress, is seeing that all of these images and thoughts and memories, all of the painful things, the longing, the fears and the anxiety, all of those things are essentially without any substance to them. In other words, through the chanting, the deceased can be reminded, that it's all ultimately illusory, and that there's nothing to fear. That yes, fear happens maybe. And by the way, these services are done for even the most seasoned Zen master. The idea being that until full enlightenment, whatever that is, until full enlightenment, there'll always be some degree of conditioning, of clinging, maybe, that can happen. And so even the most seasoned person can use some help with the chanting. So that's one way that in the service we're trying to help the deceased. The other is more specifically in the memorial prayer. The memorial prayer is sort of the climax of the whole service as a whole. In the memorial prayer, we begin, "Oh, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas." And I explained there at that funeral service in that very Catholic funeral home that Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, these are, in the deepest sense, it's our own nature. It's with Buddhas, it's our own innate wisdom. With Bodhisattvas, it's our own innate compassion. So in a sense, we're calling on Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, these great sources of enlightened energy, with or without bodies. We're calling on these Buddhas and Bodhisattvas as kind of reinforcements to come to support, to sustain the deceased through the bardo. But we're also calling on ourselves to open our hearts and really do everything we can on Hararo's behalf to prevail through whatever trials there may be in the bardo. You know, there's this widely reported phenomenon of after death, people who survive death, clinical death, who report this white light. They enter in the white light, and or people, the deceased, their predecessors, their deceased family members, calling to them, and how wonderful it is, and all. But you can't deny that that's the experience they're having. But what is that? And I think with Roshi Kapil, I would say, okay, that's the initial few minutes. What about after that? Well, who knows? I don't remember what happened after my last death, but we have this tradition, this 1500-year-old tradition that cites with a lot of consistency across the different streams of Buddhism that there is this intermediate realm that we have to come to terms with. I, in all the preparations that we were scrambling to put together the funeral service, I forgot my copy of the memorial prayer. What we do in Rochester when we have only one language to contend with is the officiant at the service, memorial or funeral service, reads each line of the memorial prayer aloud, and then those who are in attendance repeat it. And we go through three times. Well, I forgot my copy of the memorial prayer, but we did have the Spanish. And so I felt forced to recite the memorial prayer in Spanish, which wasn't a complete disaster. You know, my Spanish pronunciation isn't perfect by any means. It's a lot better than I would have than my attempting to translate it on my own. But there was that. It was a pretty stressful moment where I realized I had to do it all in Spanish. It was very heartwarming after the end of the funeral service to have not just the Sangha members, but to have Gerardo's former employees, the ones who had already retired and the ones who hadn't, come up and thank us for the service. My impression, and this is only an impression, so because how much do I know? But my impression is that there are a lot of very loyal, very devoted employees, former employees of Gerardo, who were who had been deeply affected by his generosity and his caring. I heard many stories about how much he looked after his employees. Just to wrap this up, after the funeral service ended, and we were under the gun because at the stroke of noon we had to be out of there, so we didn't have time to invite these 50 people to speak. To express their memories of Gerardo. That had to wait until the interment. Gerardo had decided to be buried rather than cremated, and after the funeral service, we went directly to the cemetery where the family plot was, his mother and father and sister who had died before him. And that's where it gets real. When you see the coffin lowered into the grave, a lot of tears. And as we were all standing there, each of us threw a flower on top of the coffin, down in the grave. These words came to me from the Chinese culture. I don't know if it was Buddhism or just more broadly China. Life is a bitter sea of suffering. The next day we had, or no, not the next day, the same day after the interment in the cemetery, we managed to find our way to a restaurant. I'd asked, are there going to be some kind of a meal afterward? This is, I think, common enough in Catholicism. I know from the funerals and interments in my wife's side of the family, the Catholics, that they call it, in her family, they call it a mercy meal. And we managed to come up with 20 people at this Japanese restaurant, and sort of put a warm feeling of togetherness in the midst of the grieving, that there was this joy that could come out of it. It's not just an ending, it's a beginning. In the beginning, we've focused on the next day when we had a Sangha meeting. It was my last day in Mexico, where the Sangha, or just some of them anyway, came together at Casa Zen now and talked about where to go from here, because Gerardo had carried that group. I'm not exaggerating. He had almost, not single-handedly, of course he had help from different Sangha members, but financially, it was mostly Gerardo that kept that group going for 45 years. He was the patron. He was the water buffalo that carried that group. And I said to them, you know, if you need to find a fault with Gerardo, it's that he provided everything. He took care of everything. In terms of management, organization, financial support, leaving them now orphans. That's their word. They said in the Sangha meeting, we are now orphans. But life goes on with the group, and they're determined to find a way to pull together and plug the holes and keep going as a Sangha. I said to them, you know, one option, just full disclosure, one option is to go to a different lineage. There's no authorized teacher there now in Mexico, fully authorized teacher. You could consider going to the lineage of another Zen teacher in Mexico City. But they all very quickly, maybe it was too soon, but they all said, no, we want to stay in the Rochester Zen Center lineage. And now I'm in contact with four, five, six of them, figuring out how that may work. Well, thank you for your patience. This was a long talk. May all beings attain Buddhahood.